Rapids, 1320 AM and W248DE broadcasting at 97.5 FM.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by Staples.
I'm Monica Ricks in New York. More severe heat's closing schools across the country. CBS's Christina Ruffini's in Washington.
It's hot, so the schools are hot and the kids are hot. Schools in nine states have had to alter their schedules because of this heat and because a lot of schools throughout the Northeast don't have adequate cooling systems. Now, that means they've either sent kids home early for the day, they've gone to remote learning, or they've had to cancel classes altogether. And a lot of the parents we talked to were frankly shocked that schools in this day and age and with this rising heat don't have air conditioning.
Boston's mayor declared a heat emergency this morning. In Turkey, rescue workers are rushing to save an American trapped more than 3,200 feet in a cave. Mark Dickey put out this video.
I look forward to working with everyone to safely get myself out with their assistance.
He can't get out himself because he's sick with gastrointestinal bleeding. Another inmate has died in Atlanta.
24-year-old Chandre Delmore is now the sixth inmate to die in Fulton County custody since the end of July. He was found unresponsive in a jail cell. Devin Franklin is with the Southern Center for Human Rights.
Until we address those systemic harms that have led to the death of so many in custody, we will continue to see these problems.
17 inmates have died while in the custody of the Fulton County Sheriff's Department in the past year. Jim Crisula, CBS News.
A judge has sentenced that 70s show star Danny Masterson to 30 years to life in prison. He was convicted back in May for raping two women 2 decades ago. The Justice Department says New Jersey failed its veterans.
The report says New Jersey's state-run veterans' homes were unprepared to keep residents safe during COVID and demonstrated a systemic inability to implement care. The scathing report outlines failures at VA facilities in Menlo Park and in Paramus. They include poor communication and staff incompetence that allowed the virus to spread virtually unchecked.
At CBS's Linda Kenyon, bills are starting to pile up for writers and actors in Hollywood who've spent months on the picket lines with no end to these strikes in sight. Alex Rubens with Pay Up Hollywood.
This is not a new problem for this community. This started in the pandemic when people were let go from their jobs, when their hours were reduced, or when their jobs were combined. So this is now a community that knows how to endure and how to take care of each other.
Also in Hollywood, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles were immortalized on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. The heroes in a half shell stamped their hands outside the TCL Chinese Theater, cementing their impact on pop culture. This is CBS News.
Staples stores provide innovative products and services for small business, remote workers and learners, even teachers and parents. Explore more at your local Staples store.
I'm getting vaccinated with Prevnar 20.
So am I, because I'm at risk for pneumococcal pneumonia.
If you're 19 or older with chronic conditions like asthma, diabetes, COPD, or heart disease, or are 65 or older, you are at increased risk for pneumococcal pneumonia. Ask your doctor or pharmacist about Prevnar 20, pneumococcal 20-valent conjugate vaccine. It can help protect you against pneumococcal pneumonia in just one dose. Even if you've already been vaccinated with other pneumonia vaccines, Prevnar 20 may help provide added protection. Prevnar 20 is approved for adults to help prevent infections from 20 strains of the bacteria that cause pneumococcal pneumonia. Continued approval may depend on a supportive study. Don't get Prevnar 20 if you've had a severe allergic reaction to the vaccine or its ingredients. Adults with weakened immune systems may have a lower response to the vaccine. Side effects include pain and swelling at the injection site, fatigue, headache, muscle, and joint pain. For full prescribing information, please call 1-855-213-2138 or visit Prevnar20.com.
For WFHR and WIRI, I'm Melissa Kay. Here's what you need to know in central Wisconsin. The Wood County Agriculture and Household Clean Sweep is Saturday, September 9th at Saratoga Hall from 8 to noon. This is for all Wood County residents to dispose of hazardous waste without charge, but there are restrictions on quantities. Materials should be properly identified in their original containers with original labels. You must stay in your vehicle at all times. Materials will be unloaded from your trunk, pickup bed, or trailer only. Do not put materials in your backseat area. Contact the Wood County Health Department with questions at 715-421-8911. The community book sale is coming up in October at the Moravian Church in Wisconsin Rapids. The sale will take place October 12th through the 14th at 310 First Avenue South. 100% of the profits will go to Mid-State Technical College scholarships. Most books are only a dollar. They do accept credit cards and they have an elevator. I'm Melissa Kay for WFHR and WIRI.
Here's your forecast from locally grown radio WFHR. Mainly cloudy skies expected tonight with lows around 48. Northeast winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Mainly sunny tomorrow, high of 73. Tomorrow night, lows around 47. Highs around 80 Saturday under mainly sunny skies. 71 Sunday, chance for scattered rain showers. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Jennifer Wojcicki. Currently, it's 63.
Welcome, everyone, to Midday Magazine for this September 7th, 2023. Have your host, James J. Mailoff, here. At 3:30, we're going to welcome in Janelle Weir, horticultural educator with UW-Madison Extension Wood County. Right now, we have in studio with us CEO of your United Way of South Wood and Adams Counties, Terry Johns.
Hello.
Hey, Terry. Good to see you.
Thanks. Good to see you.
And you brought in a new friend.
I did. I have with me today Brian DeWitt, who is our campaign chair this year. Does his day work at ERCO Worldwide.
Yeah.
But really has been spending a lot of time with us at United Way, is a board member, and, you know, has been spending time helping us promote the campaign. So I'll let him give a little intro background and what brought him to United Way.
Brian, I appreciate you joining us, and I really appreciate what you put into our community, being a part of the United Way, whether it's a board member or now in your new role as a chairman. I'm curious, get to know a little bit about you. Where are you from? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, so I've grown up in Wisconsin Rapids my entire life, lived here, kind of seen the struggles in the community as the paper industry kind of went away or dried up in the 90s. So I've just seen the good that the United Way does in the community. And the benefits, you know, they bring benefits to over 30 partner programs. So I'm just, you know, excited to be involved, excited to, you know, be a contributing member of the community. And,
what was one of the first things that you got involved with the United Way?
Well, early on, you know, when you're first starting your career, I mean, you take part in the employer programs.
Yeah.
So that's my first introduction to the United Way. But then just over the course of the years, finding out all the programs that they interface with and help. So
we've gotten to meet a couple of chairmen over the years, you and I, Terry. And one of the common themes is this is usually how it starts. It starts with maybe the donating from your paycheck or something. And you kind of follow that. We tend to follow our investments. And you see all the things that money does, all the impact that makes in our community.
Absolutely.
And that kind of intrigues you a little bit. Maybe you want to be involved a little bit more. And before you know it, Terry's making you the chairman.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
It's a very gentle ask. It's a gentle arm twist.
Yeah. Brian, when it comes to this position and going forward over the next year, what are you hoping to accomplish?
Well, just to have a successful campaign, you know, kind of bring awareness to the struggles in our community. One of the things that the United Way does is they look at, there's the federal poverty line, but there's also this thing called the ALICE line. So that's asset limited, income constrained, but employed. Mm-hmm. And what it is it's a line that takes a look at reality and looks at rent, what people spend on average for food, and says, okay, the federal poverty line is too low. This is our actual poverty line. And believe it or not, there's over 40% of homes in Wisconsin Rapids and Wood County alone that fall under that line. Mm-hmm. So just kind of exemplifies what the United Way can do and the number of folks that they help.
We work over at ERCO. Mm-hmm. ERCO and the United Way have worked together before, of course. And we see ERCO sponsoring so many different things in this community. I haven't gotten a chance to talk to many people over there, though.
Sure.
It does seem like it's something that's in the almost the bylines of ERCO that you guys really believe in putting back into the community.
Absolutely, we do. And one of the things I do as part of my job over there is I'm involved in some of those social contributions, our donation activity. So, yeah, we kind of take pride in being involved in the community. You know, we want to be good stewards and just help people in our area.
Why did you want to take this position? Was it the arm twist or did you really want it? No.
It fit nicely with the role. You know, honestly, as I started at ERCO, they asked me to get involved. And since I've been involved, it's become a little bit of a passion, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like I get to see different aspects of the community and, like I said, the different good that the United Way does in the community. So, you know, if I ever leave IRCO, I would still stay involved just because, like I said, the United Way is an important cause and does a lot of good.
Yeah, it seems like, too, one of those things where when you get involved with it and you start realizing all the things that they can do, well, I want to make an impact on my community. Where can I do that best? Mm-hmm. The United Way.
Absolutely.
You want to be able to hit more, as many things as you can with one target.
Yep.
You know, that's the United Way. They're so good at that.
Absolutely.
Terry, when you are looking for a campaign chair, what is one of the main things that you are looking for?
A weak arm. I'm just kidding. Just teasing. Brian, you don't have a weak arm. I'm just giving you a hard time. You know, honestly, a couple of things. One primarily is, I mean, you just heard Brian, right? Like he could just put me out of business, right? Like he's very well versed and yes, really, and that's yeah. good. That's a good thing, right? So care and commitment to the community is really a big deal. And then of course, it's very helpful when an individual has been a donor in the past, mm-hmm. right? Because you kind of get that and not just what we're doing with the money, but you're willing to personally invest. And yeah. so that has to play into the equation of being the campaign chair. Also, you know, before when you were talking about, you know, IRCO and their social responsibility mm-hmm. and being part of community, IRCO has been in our top three campaigns for a long time. And when mm-hmm. I say top three, I'm saying like total dollars raised, yeah, yeah. you know, and it's not a huge workforce. I mean, it's 100-ish.
Yep. Yeah.
And so, I mean, when you think about that, we certainly have larger employers, but what it shows is just the level of commitment mm-hmm. to community and specifically to United Way. So not only does Brian have to come out with me and, you know, do all this kind of fun stuff, and, you know, you should ask him about his first campaign presentation because it was a really big one.
Yeah, that's coming up.
So there's that. But then there's also, you know, kind of the responsibility of that person who is our campaign chair is often the lead within their company, mm-hmm. right? So there, you know, there's also that lift of running the campaign within their own organization and making sure that it's successful and big shoes to fill at IRCO, which, you know, Brian easily was able to do last year. And we, you know, look forward to continuing to see that growth opportunity as it pertains to IRCO specifically, but then community wide, you know, what can be done to increase participation and how can Brian sharing his message of why he and his wife and family, mm-hmm. you know, why they are committed to United Way and how that might translate to you. You know, yeah. what is something that Brian might say or mm-hmm. I might say or any other future campaign chair might say. One thing that's really fun, mm-hmm. so this is my 16th campaign mm-hmm. and I have had fabulous campaign chairs the whole way through. And one time we had a campaign chair because of health reasons have to back out like very last minute. And I just had this group just rally and be like, okay, we're stepping in, you know, we'll do mm-hmm. it. So, I mean, we've always been very blessed with a strong campaign chair or team. But it's really fun when it's somebody who grew up here.
Yeah.
Because already, I mean, one day, Brian's mom said, hey, you know my son. Mm-hmm. He's, you know, so that's yeah, really cool.
That is really
but
cool.
Last night I was at the Kiwanis because they presented United Way with a check. And someone there said, oh, good choice on Brian DeWitt. So that's really, it's really fun. Yeah. You know what I mean? When it's someone local. And mm-hmm. I also grew up here. So it, you know, everybody knows everybody. And, right. and that's, but that's cool, you know, mm-hmm. to just see because now those people who sometime in Brian's, you know, years of life that cross paths. And mm-hmm. so there's a connection. And yeah. I think that makes a difference too.
Well, especially when it comes to not only knowing the area and the people in the area, but the concerns and really the mission of the United Way, of whether it's Alice or it's some of the other things we talk about from time to time, whenever you join us, Terry, it's knowing, having an insight that not everybody has to this area. I think that's very helpful, too. I'm curious, Brian, you knew the United Way, you were a donor for the United Way going into this. As you are approached about this position and you're learning more about it, are there things that the United Way does that you weren't even aware of?
Oh, gosh, yeah. There's out of the 30 partner programs, I would say that a good majority of those programs I wasn't aware of. You know, you look at like Career Closet on Baker Street, just this little tiny space where they're doing clothes for people that are going into the workforce that can't otherwise afford clothes. I didn't even know they existed. Mm-hmm. So until I was part of the United Way, that program was, you know, non-existent to me. Yeah. And there's all sorts of other programs in the community like that that I didn't know they funded. You look at the dental through Aspirus. It is the only clinic in our area that provides dental care to folks on Medicaid. And it's such an important program because otherwise these folks would be underserved or not served at all.
And Brian's a smart guy. Brian's been with the United, been involved with the United Way for a while as a donor and all that. You're in the know. You're from this area. And even you didn't know everything the United Way does.
Oh, yeah.
And I've been in a similar boat, too, when Terry and I first started talking. And I thought I knew. My mom is a huge fan of the United Way. I thought I knew everything. There's at least two or three programs off the top of my head I could think of that I didn't know until Terry told me about them.
Yeah.
So it's so important when Terry joins us, when we're talking about the United Way at any of these programs, it may seem sometimes like, well, we knew about that already. Somebody didn't. Right. There's something out there that somebody didn't know because you guys cover so much. And it's a good thing how much you cover, but it also makes it our job to make sure that all these things you guys out there are aware of.
It is. It's the blessing and the curse, right? Yeah. So we try to be very specific and driven in the areas that we support. So mm-hmm. when we think about education, financial stability, health, emergency food and shelter. So those are kind of the categories.
Yeah.
But then when you get into the depth of it a little bit, it's like we want to be able to serve as many programs that are addressing those goals as possible. But that also makes it sometimes hard to say what we do, you know. And so, yes, so as much educating as we can do in opportunities like this, you know, with public information, we have a fabulous quarterly newsletter that you can get by mail or in your email, you know, where we try to cover these things in a way that, you know, we're not always just repeating and summarizing, but sometimes you have to, right? Like you got to bring it back to the beginning, like you said, because we might know about it or every, you know, 50% of the people might know about it, but 50% don't. And so that is, can be a challenge for us, is just really educating on, you know, like Brian referenced, 30 programs. Well, 30 programs is a lot, but those are the programs that we help to fund. But then there's also the work, you know, internally that our own staff is doing. We have 10 different initiatives. We've got the 2-1-1 program, volunteer centers. So there really is a lot of, you know, as wide as we are, we're probably equally as deep. So it can be a challenge.
Yeah. Brian, what is something that you're looking forward to over the next year when it comes to being the chairman of the United Way?
Just the interaction with the community, talking to people that I haven't talked to before, just getting out there and letting people know what the United Way is about and what they do in the community. You know, the other thing I would mention too, Terry kind of touched on some of the other programs. Check out the United Way's website. So Google United Way of Southwood in Adams County. They've got some great features on there. You can volunteer. You can see what the 2-1-1 program does. It's a really nice site, and it's a good way to get some more information.
It's an easy one to remember, too. I got to be honest, like uwswac.org. Like, it's just so, it flows so well. It's an easier one, too. It is a fantastic website. I'm very right about that. Terry, what is in store for Brian? What are some of the duties that this job entails?
Are you trying to scare him?
A little. No. I'm curious.
Well, okay, so front-end stuff that we've already done, right? So, you know, we do an introduction in our newsletter. We, you know, ask Brian. To serve, if they're not already, we ask the campaign chair to serve on our board for at least the year that they are the campaign chair. Brian's already a board member, so that, you know, that fits. But sometimes we identify someone who will serve as campaign chair but isn't serving on the board. So that's another, you know, commitment, I guess, that we ask of our campaign chair. We had a campaign volunteer training, which Pam, you know, from Civic Media team was able to participate in. And that's, you know, really getting out and talking about what's with individuals who coordinate company campaigns and helping them understand with a little more depth what we're doing so that when there's questions. So that's kind of the starting stuff. And then now we are into campaign presentations where organizations and businesses will invite us to come and speak to, it could be their whole team, like we did at WRPS last week, or Port Edward Schools. We've already been there as well. Or it could be we have an upcoming one with Aspirus, and that's their leadership team meeting. So it's all of the department leads, you know, come together for a meeting, and they give us some time to do that. So we're going in talking about the importance of giving to United Way, the importance of helping if we're talking to just a small delegation, you know, what they can do to help garner more participation within their organization. So, you know, we're really out talking in the community and then, of course, doing things like this, right? Just general awareness around campaign. And, you know, in addition to that, Brian can really Brian can promote United Way, you know, fabulously, as you've heard, but do that, you know, however it makes sense to do that amongst his own peers and with with other opportunities. Brian also sits on the board for the Mid-State Technical College Foundation. And so, you know, sometimes there's folks there that he's rubbing shoulders with that, you know, when it's appropriate. Of course, we don't, you know, we stay in our lane, but when it's appropriate, I mean, Mid-State has a fabulous campaign. And so with Brian's leadership on the United Way side, how does that translate to what's happening at Mid-State as well? So, you know, really between now and the probably the most fun thing, and that's why we save it till the end, is we have our sweepstakes prize presentations in December. And so Brian's also invited to come do that and give people $1,000 checks. I mean,
that just got
it's really painful.
Yeah, it's got to be.
And then our campaign thank you celebration, which happens in early January, you know, which is an opportunity to showcase individuals. Like we showcase all of our leadership level givers, which is $500 or more to the campaign from a household, but then also community cornerstone partners, which is, you know, companies at different levels of giving. And so just saying, you know, hey, ERCO, hey, Domtar, you know, whoever you are, you know, thank you for giving at this level. And that's something, you know, that the campaign chair really, really gets to do.
So we got to talk about this. You mentioned Brian's first campaign, first time that he did this or whatever. How'd that go?
Really well.
It went well. Yeah. So I got to say, it's the first time I've spoken in front of that many people.
Yeah.
900, just to give an idea.
Ooh. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's so a good number right there.
Right, yeah. So when I was told, I was a little nervous at first. Like I said, you know, United Way is a good cause, so I wasn't afraid to get up there. But
he did fabulous. So here's the thing I like about this. I'm glad that we don't have to lead up to it. I'm glad it's always first. So it's Wisconsin Rapids Public Schools. They're in service. They bring everybody together in the Performing Arts Center, and if needed, in overflow in the cafeteria at Lincoln High School. And I mean, and it's like really a rip the Band-Aid off, right?
Yeah. Like, yeah.
Here you go up on stage, and you hope the lights are down so you can't see people.
Yes.
Well, they were kind of up this year, so like you could see that it was full. But no, he did fabulous, and I've heard nothing but good from, you know, WRPS employees who might have been there, been part of it, with the message. And I mean, that's the idea, right? Like tug at somebody's heartstrings so that they see why they should be part of United Way.
Speaking with CEO of your United Way of Southwood and Adams Counties, Terry Johns, along with Brian DeWitt, 2023 campaign chair. And I'm very glad that Brian is busy with ERCO, with this campaign chair. This is his first time in radio, everybody, and he sounds amazing. He sounds great.
I know you and I are done.
Yeah, we're done. Like Brian's going to be running the shows from now on, everybody. It is campaign season. I wanted to get into a little of that with you, Terry.
Yeah, so, I mean, here we go, right? Yeah. Like, we officially always say we kick off on September 1st. I think a lot of companies right now are in the organizing phase. You know, typically, there's not many that get done other than schools, because that makes sense. We can get in front of those audiences. But typically, not till after Labor Day, you know, our company's kicking off. But there's a lot of organization and planning that's going on now, and then we're getting out and talking with people as we can. We also dropped our most of our mailings last Friday, but there's another mailing that goes out yet this week. And so I think the really big thing this early on in the campaign that I can say is feedback that we get of why someone doesn't give is not always, but often, I wasn't asked. And so if you're listening, consider yourself asked. Even if you didn't get something in the mail, things change so quickly with the postal system, with, you know, lists that we have and that kind of thing. And we try to be really smart and cost effective about mailings and how we're reaching people. But we do know and we understand that sometimes it just doesn't happen, right? And so I think that's, you know, being only in week one, that's the best feedback that I can really throw out there is, you know, if you haven't been asked, you're not part of a workplace that has a campaign, you didn't or haven't won't receive something in the mail for whatever reason, you know, we still invite you to engage and be part of this process. You can give in a variety of different ways. You could give through payroll deduction at your workplace. You can give if you visit our website at uwswac.org. You click on donate, and you can see all the ways that you can give. We have PayPal. We have Venmo. We can do ACH withdrawals, because sometimes someone retires. Maybe you've given $20 a paycheck for ever, and you say, you know, I kind of want to keep just doing that. Could you just take, you know, $40 a month out of my checking? They just fill out a form. We can do that. You can write us a check. You can drop off cash. I'll come pick it up. We will do, you know, we want it to be as easy as possible for the donor to be able to continue or start giving. So why give? Your donation combined with everyone else's donation has the power to impact 20,000 individuals here in our community. None, not $1 of your individual donation leaves the community. So James, you say, hey, I'm going to donate, you know, $52 to the United Way dollar a week. That's kind of a starting goal that we have for folks who haven't been donors, or or maybe they want to increase, you know, they're under that. But to qualify for our sweepstakes, it's $52. So we kind of just throw that out there. Dollar a week. You can find it. Well, when people used to carry money, remember when we carried money? Like, you can find that in the couch cushions.
Right.
Or in your car floor or, you know, something. But so $1 a week. And that's, you know, really the goal. But when we combine all of that, we're talking about raising about $625,000 and impacting 20,000 people. Nowhere else can you do that with a donation of $1 a week. Nowhere else can you make that impact.
Yeah, especially and then you put that microscope in a little bit closer in your own neck of the woods.
Exactly.
And certainly this is the case with United Ways around the country. And where you're listening to us, we encourage you to back your United Way. We're a little biased around here about our own, but it don't mean we're wrong. Our United Way is so strong and does such a great job in this community. When you are looking to make the most out of your investment, this is it.
Absolutely. And if you say, you know what, I'm just really, really, really passionate about hunger, you can indicate that. You can say, I want it to go to the food strategy area, right, instead of just to the general campaign fund. So you as the donor have the ability to do that and do make your, you know, charitable giving and your community investment through United Way, either in general or to targeted areas. Do you want to just touch on sweepstakes since I brought that up earlier? We do have a sweepstakes. If you give $1 a week, you qualify. And the way that sweepstakes is possible is through sponsorships. So we have five companies who sponsor $1,000 each. So this is not coming out of campaign funds, because sometimes that question does come to the surface. So those companies are Aspirus Health, Gunderson Moundview Hospital and Clinics, Next Home Partners, Prevail Bank, and Williams Heating and Plumbing. So each of those gave $1,000 to say, you know, we want to see more donors to the campaign. And ultimately, that's what this is about. So if you are a current giver, if you increase your donation by $26, you qualify. If you are not a donor or you're under the dollar a week, get up to $52 and you also qualify. And we give those out the week before Christmas.
Yeah, that's nice.
Super fun. Yeah, it's a great way to do it. So it is a really, really good idea. And one other just, you know, unique thing that we have this year is we do have a match from the Legacy Foundation of Central Wisconsin. And this is a match to the first $500,000 to the campaign that will go into our endowment. So it doesn't go to the general campaign. We still need to raise that money in the community like we always have. But the match will go to our endowment, which the income and earnings is used to offset any fundraising costs that we have. That's what gets 100% of your dollar back out into the community. So this is a huge opportunity year for us. You know, we've been, I don't know, kind of sitting on our hands a little bit since COVID. Not we United Way, but just in general, reluctance. The economy has not been friendly to people. We're asking you to scrounge up that dollar a week, because probably everyone can do it. It might be a little bit more painful for some than others, but we really just encourage you to think about friends, family, neighbors in need, and support United Way.
When you're looking at when you're looking at donating to something, why are you doing it? You're donating because you see this as a cause. You see this as something that you care about that you think needs attention. Maybe you're also looking at it as the big picture and the impact that it can make in the future. You can't ask for more than that. All the above just covered with a dollar right there. How many things in life can you do that? You can't even go to the dollar store anymore and get things for a dollar. It's pretty cool. It's pretty impressive. And it's one of those things that I agree, Terry, not only can everybody do, I think that more and more people want to do. And I think that's why it was really important to what you were giving us before about the different ways you can donate. It's kind of funny, too, I have to say as a side note, my mom loves Terry. And I had a question specifically for her that I was supposed to ask, and she already answered it. That's how good Terry is. Nice. I was going to ask off air, but she was wondering about retirement and if she could still be able to donate, and she was curious about that. So I think that not only is that information we should get out there for more and more people to know, but thank you also for... By the way, you and my mom cannot talk. It's hard enough handling you. I already have a hard enough time. I don't need you partnering up with her and my whole life changing.
Well, now that I don't see her at the library anymore, I don't know. I'll have to seek her out at the grocery store.
It's important stuff to know for those wanting to give and wanting to put into. And this is an investment. This is you putting into this. You could use all the terms you want, charity, et cetera, et cetera. This is an investment. Quick example, the Imagination Library. It's something that I do every year. I've been doing since Terry and first brought it to us, and it's important to me. That is $30 that I don't look at as $30 that I'm donating. That's an investment. I want our future stronger. I want our kids to be able to read better. I'm not doing this just to be nice. I'm doing it because I want a better future. I believe in this. Well, it's stuff like that.
And where else can you get a year's worth of good quality books for $30? Right? I mean, like, you know, it's return on investment as well. I was going to say, bang for your buck. Same thing. But it, you know, the our return on investment on that is just it's exponential, and we really can't even hardly measure it, right? Like, just making sure that kids have those resources of their own.
Yeah.
Not that they have to go get or that they get from somewhere else, but that they have at home. So it's priceless.
It really is. And unwordable, which is tough in radio because you really got to, you know, got to talk. Terry, thank you so much for joining us. Brian, great to meet you.
Yeah, you as well.
Thanks, James. Appreciate the time. If you want to find out more, go to uwswac.org. Be sure to follow the United Way on social media as well. It's a great way to follow and find out what's going on in your area. Thank you both for the time.
You bet.
Thanks. We'll have more Midday Magazine coming up right here on WFHR, locally grown radio.
Locally grown 1320 AM and 97.5 FM WFHR programming is broadcast from the Bug Tussle Studios. Bug Tussle, keeping you connected to the world around you.
For WFHR and WIRI, I'm Melissa Kay. Here's what you need to know in Central Wisconsin. The Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection is accepting applications for dairy processor grants now through October 13th. These grants aim to foster innovation, improve profitability, and sustain the long-term viability of Wisconsin's dairy processing facilities. A total of $500,000 is available as part of Governor Evers' biennial budget. Grants will be awarded for projects up to $75,000 and 2 years in duration. Processors are required to provide a match of 20% of the grant amount and chosen through a competitive selection process. Visit datcp.wi.gov for more information. FRM Music Fest is taking place in Wisconsin Rapids this Saturday. The fest runs from 1 to 9 p.m. at Robinson Park. The Kids Zone is open from 1 to 6:30 and free for kids age 12 and under. I'm Melissa Kay for WFHR and WIRI.
Here's your forecast from locally grown radio WFHR. Mainly cloudy skies expected tonight with lows around 48. Northeast winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Mainly sunny tomorrow, high of 73. Tomorrow night, lows around 47. Highs around 80 Saturday under mainly sunny skies. 71 Sunday, chance for scattered rain showers. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Jennifer Wojcicki. Currently, it's 63.
Welcome, everyone, to Midday Magazine for the September 7th, 2023. I have your host, James J. Maloff, here. I am joined by our great friend, Janelle Weir, horticultural educator with UW-Madison Extension, Wood County. Janelle, it's been too long. It's
been... Yeah, it's funny. We were just talking last week how, you know, it seemed like it was pretty quick, and here I am right back next week.
Appreciate you pitch hitting. Thank you very much for being in with us today, and especially with the topic we're going to get to, because we kind of teased this a little bit already. We're diving into storing tender bulbs for the winter.
Yeah. So it's, you know, with a change in temperature and kind of the weather's working out for me perfectly because the heat finally broke. And so it's time to start thinking about if you have tender bulbs, how are you going to store them over the winter time? So tender bulbs here, what I'm talking about are caladiums, calla lilies, canna lilies, dahlias, gladiolus, and tuberous begonias. There's some other tender bulbs out there too, but though that kind of gives you an idea of what I'm talking about. Now, these are not winter hardy, but the good news is because they have these structures, these bulbs, we can actually store them over the winter, and it's pretty easy to store them. That makes it less expensive, so that way you don't have to replace them every year.
Interesting. So what about how you store them or the digging part of this part?
Yeah, so the first thing you're going to want to do is either dry them down. So if you've got them in containers, you can dry them down. Otherwise, wait until the first frost hits and it kills off the foliage, or maybe a couple of frosts, light frosts. If it's a really light frost, let them get hit by a couple of light frosts. You don't want them staying in the ground once the frost has hit them, though. So as soon as the frost hits, you're going to want to dig them up pretty quickly. Otherwise, you'll start to run into rotting issues inside the ground or inside that container. So what you're going to want to do is just very lightly dig them up, and then you're going to lightly dust off all the dirt off of them. But you want to be careful that you're not damaging. If there's a some bulbs have a papery skin on the outside. If it's one of those bulbs that has a papery skin, don't damage that papery skin. If you damage that papery skin, what you're doing is encouraging opportunities for rotting to happen over the winter time.
How about keeping them clean?
Yeah, so you can dust them off. If you do wash them, you're going to be careful with them again. Again, we're really trying hard not to damage that. We don't want any bruising. Think about them kind of like a fruit, right? So they'll bruise, and if they bruise, well, that's when the rotting's going to happen over the wintertime. So really be careful with them. And if it's the type of bulb that you would divide, so here I'm kind of thinking about dahlia tubers, go ahead and wait until the spring to divide them. And the reason why, again, is we're trying to avoid having any open wounds. We want to avoid any opportunities for rotting. The real danger over the winter time storing them is there's a real opportunity for them to rot. And so what we're doing is just trying to reduce any opportunities for that.
So what about curry?
Yeah, so what you're going to want to do is now you've got them clean. If you rinse them off really gently, we need to let them dry. Regardless of if you rinse them off with water, you still need to let them dry for a few days. 1 to 3 days is going to be fine for most of your bulbs. Some of them like to dry a little bit longer, though. Here I'm thinking about the calla lilies and the gladiolus. Drying them, you're going to do that really kind of like how you would dry herbs or flowers or anything else. So indirect light, nice dry conditions. If you've got them in a humid spot, it's going to take a lot longer for them to cure. So nice, dry, cool location. And then with gladiolus, because the type of bulb in here, I'm using the word bulb in air quotes, it's actually not a bulb, it's a corm. The only reason why this is particularly important is what you'll notice is there'll be a kind of like a little shriveled structure. That was the mother corm from last year. You can go ahead and just knock that off. And what happens is just the way that the gladiolus reproduces over time. The corm that you plant this year is going to produce next year's corm. Go ahead and knock off. If you've got a shriveled corm on a gladiolus, go ahead and just knock that off.
When it comes to storing this, now all these steps are vital and important. Certainly the storing part has got to have a little bit more to it and got to be the most vital part of almost.
Yeah, so with storing, you got to be, here's what you're basically doing is you're going to store them in some sort of material. And the purpose of that material is kind of twofold. So you want something that is going to both pull moisture if those bulbs are too wet, or if the bulbs are too dry, they're going to give that moisture back to them. So you want some sort of material that's going to moderate moisture. You got a lot of different options. You could use sand. peat is a great one. Yeah. You could use sawdust. You could even use shredded newspaper. Okay. Any of those materials are going to have that moderating effect with moisture. So what you're going to do is you want some sort of container. You know, you could use a plastic bin, although if you do use a plastic big bin, make sure that you don't keep the top of it sealed. You don't want airtight containers. Honestly, storage boxes are going to be probably best thing that you could use because they're not airtight. They've got some air circulation in there. Remember, the main thing we're trying to do or main thing we're trying to avoid is any rotting. Okay.
Right.
So you could dust the bulbs first with some sort of fungicide. Fungicides come in, so you wouldn't use a liquid one here. You would use one that came as a dust. I think sulfur would probably work really nicely for you. Lightly dust them, kind of like how you would dust a chicken breast if you were making fried chicken, right? So maybe a gallon-sized paper plastic bag or a plastic garbage bag with some of that that fungicide, dust fungicide in there, and just give it a little shake. After that, you're going to want to make sure that you're labeling your bulbs, okay? There's nothing worse than pulling out your bulbs and not knowing, you know, especially if you're potting them up and you want to pot them up into particular arrangements, you're going to want to know not only which one is a begonia, but what color was that begonia, right? So now's the time to get those labels on because you won't remember in the spring. I promise you, you won't. And then you could, how you label them, well, if you're storing them in paper bags, you can just write it right, you know, put it, write it, label it with a Sharpie right on the bag. I've seen people actually label with a fine tip Sharpie right on the bulbs themselves if the bulbs are big enough. So there I'm kind of thinking about like an elephant ear. You know, those tend to be rather large. Or, you know, you can come up with whatever different solutions. Next, you're going to store those bulbs, and the way you're going to do them is you're going to layer that material. Remember, I mentioned like peat or sand, whatever that material it is that you're using. You're going to put about a 2-inch layer on the bottom, and then now you're going to layer your bulbs, okay? You don't want the bulbs to touch each other. If they touch each other, if one of them starts to rot, it's going to cause the other one to rot. They're going to share that. Think about this. The rotting is a disease.
Right.
It's basically what's happening is a plant disease, right? So if they're touching each other, they're definitely going to share that disease. Don't want them to touch each other. Go ahead and put a nice even layer down. Put another layer of that peat moss or whatever that packing material is, a couple of inches deep, and then keep layering them until you've got your container full.
All these steps are important. It's also, it doesn't seem like impossible. It doesn't seem like there's so much to this that I think is so cool that we've gotten to a point in life and society and all that where we can keep these plants, you know, around for a whole year. Now I know they can't be out for display, but the fact that you still have them and can pull them right out again, you don't have to buy new ones. Just the process is fascinating to me. It's interesting.
You know, I had a, I believe it's called a Skagum begonia. So it's a type of a tuberous begonia. And when I first bought the bulb, it was a little bit smaller than my fist. And I had it for several years, probably like 7 or 8 years. When that last year that I pulled it out, I want to say, I'm trying to think of what, it was getting close to the size of a icebox watermelon.
Whoa.
It got big.
Yeah.
It got really big. I mean, it was becoming a challenge every year of, okay, what container am I going to put you in?
That's the first thing I thought. Wow, yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Just that's even possible. I think for a lot of us that I wasn't born with any green, even a black thumb. I mean, I really am learning about this stuff as you and I talk about it. That's awesome. That is really interesting. And I know that my mom does this every year. But I mean, again, I grew up with a woman and I still didn't even catch half of these things that she does. It's interesting. So even when it's that close to home, you don't always get this stuff.
Yeah, my mom had a green thumb, and I didn't know any, like, I wasn't paying attention to anything. You would think that I probably learned from her. No, no. And it's funny, I think about my kids, and so much of their life I have been working with plants. Do they know a whole lot about plants? You know, the two older ones a little bit more. My oldest probably because she worked with me at a greenhouse. Oh. Youngest barely is aware that plants exist. I forgot what she told me the other day, but she referred to something as a grass. And it was like a tree or something. I was just like, what did you say?
That's awesome. So one last thing about this, as far as the keep up on keeping an eye on them, checking in on them and everything, is there any notes on that?
I would just make sure that you're going down in the basement, pulling out your bulbs and just checking to see, number one, are they rotting? If you've noticed that there's a soft spot on any of them, get rid of it. Don't keep it around. It's just going to continue to get worse. So if you find one that's got a soft spot, yank it. And then my other thought would be take a look at them. And if they seem like they're starting to get a little bit too dry, a little bit too shriveled, very, very lightly mist them and then pack them back inside the packing material.
It's good stuff. Thank you for that. Again, we're speaking with Janelle Weir, horticultural educator with UW-Madison Extension. And Janelle, well, let's talk about bringing the plants indoors now. We've talked about that process. Now let's get to this part about bringing them in the house.
Yeah, so this is going to be what I was talking about previously, where bulbs that, you know, they're outdoor plants that we keep outdoors for containers or inside the ground. Now what I want to switch gears is if you had house plants that were at summer vacation outside in the backyard all summer, now's the time to start thinking about bringing them in. We still have a couple of weeks before our first frost, but the process of bringing them in, if you don't want them to be really stressed out and drop all of their leaves, you can reduce that stress by starting that process now.
Yeah.
So one of the first things I want to think about is light. What we're going to do, if you have ever gotten vegetables in the spring from a greenhouse, say like tomatoes, and you hearted them off in the spring by slowly exposing them to more and more light, so that way when you plant them, they don't end up getting a sun scald. What you're going to do is the exact opposite process here. So you're slowly going to gradually give them less and less light. Even if you've got a really, really bright solarium inside your house, at still going to be less light than if they were in a very shady backyard all summer long. Okay. So what you're going to do is, you know, if you've got them in full sun, you're going to just slowly put them someplace where they're going to get a little bit less light over a 2-week period. Okay. If they were in a shady spot, gradually bring them into a shadier and shadier spot. Okay. So once you've gotten them slowly exposed to less light, when you do bring them inside the house, they're going to lose less leaves. If anybody is out there has ever had a hibiscus, I think a hibiscus is a perfect example for this. If you've ever had a tropical hibiscus and you brought it inside for the winter and you notice like within 10 days it's dropped 90% of its leaves, regrow those leaves. And what's happened is when they do regrow those leaves, they regrow them and the new leaves will be adapted to less light exposure. But if you slowly reduce the light, they'll get adapted over time. So you don't have to go through all of that.
Plants are so smart.
Oh, yeah.
They're so intelligent. Yeah. That's really interesting.
So that's how you get around, you know, even now I say this. If you do that, please don't call me at the extension office if your hibiscus still loses a couple of leaves. You're still going to lose some leaves. You're just not going to have that shocking 90% leaf drop that you would have if you would have brought it from full sun to your sunny solarium.
You have a line in your notes here, do not bring hitchhikers indoors. It's not very often that we have a good note for humans and plants. It doesn't happen very often. It's funny, but it's also a big part of this process is making sure that there's no pests on the plants.
Absolutely. So once you've gotten the plant adjusted to lower light levels, now we're at the time we're going to bring them inside, right? Because that was like about a 2-week process that you were reducing
Thank you
light.
For that. I meant to ask how long you should take that with that process.
About a 10 days to 2 weeks. Nice. Yeah, that should be good. So now you've gone through that reduction of light. Now it's time to start thinking about what do I need to do bring that plant inside. First thing, you're going to pop that plant. If it's small enough, pop the plant out of the container that it's in. Take a look at the bottom of the pot. Are there any pests, maybe roly-polies down there? Sometimes there's frogs down there or salamanders. So you want to make sure you're not bringing any surprises in. Take a look at the root ball. Do you have any maybe root mealies or any other insects in there? There might even be centipedes in there, right? Maybe rinse out the inside of that pot. Make sure that you're not bringing anything inside. And then, you know, what we're going to be doing is kind of just thinking about, you know, we talk a lot about pest management in here, right? When I come on the radio, we're going to apply those principles to our indoor plants as well. So we're going to be thinking about the different types of plants that we've got and what pests might they be susceptible to. I've got a beautiful giant old jade at home. That guy I know is going to end up, well, hopefully he won't, but he probably will, might get mealy bugs because he's very, very susceptible to mealy bugs, right? So I'm going to be looking for evidence of mealy bugs on there and try to maybe rinse them off with water really, really well before I bring them inside.
Is that, well, I imagine it's different per per insect, but is that one of the better ways of getting, removing these pests off of there gently or, you know, safely so you're not hurting the plant?
Yes, I would, all of the plants, I would give them a good bath. And what I would do is I would tip them on their sides. So I take them out of the container, tip them on their sides, and rinse the undersides of the leaves with a really gentle stream. Depending on how strong the leaves are, that's how strong the stream of water can be. Okay. Some leaves are going to be, you know, some leaves, if you put a stream of water on them, they'll tear pretty easily, right? Yeah. So you just got to be kind of careful about that. Jade plant, you can be pretty ruthless with, you know, with blasting it with water. All the plants, give them a good rinse with water. This is going to probably knock off anywhere between, I don't know, maybe 75-80% of any eggs or adults that are on there. Now, remember, you know, there's a good chance that, you know, with some pests, you know, if you even bring in a single egg inside, eventually that population will build up. I'm thinking about aphids, right? So aphid females are born pregnant. Yeah.
What a life.
Yeah, and they give birth to live young. And so all it takes is one female surviving, one female egg surviving. Well, no, they're live young, but one female surviving, that eventually you'll end up with a population. So because of that, what I like to do, you know, for basically all of my non-edible plants that I'm bringing inside, I'll go ahead and give them a systemic insecticide. The way a systemic insecticide works is it, the plant will take it up through the roots and distribute it throughout the entire plant. And it'll protect the plant for about an 8-week period. And I will do this both for my flowering plants and my non-flowering plants. What I'll do is I'll pick the flowers off of my plants while I'm adjusting that light in that 2-week period. I'll give them that systemic insecticide. And then after about 10 days, that should be distributed throughout my entire plant. Then I'll go ahead and bring my plants inside. I'm not too worried about using a systemic insecticide for flowering plants indoors,
right?
Because I don't have pollinators indoors.
So
I can use that without really worrying too much about it. Outdoors, I'm a little bit more judicious about where I use my systemic insecticides, but indoors, I shouldn't have any pollinators.
Yeah, right. And it's nice to know, you know, where they can have these uses, some of those insecticides.
That's one of my favorite applications for systemic insecticides. There's, you know, a lot of, there's a lot of responsible ways that you can use all sorts of different pesticides. It's just a matter of, you know, thinking through, how am I, what am I using this for, and what could be a potential unintended target?
When I was a kid, some of the first chores I had was doing laundry when I was about 10 or 12, somewhere in between there. And I'd do laundry, and afterwards, I'd go water my mom's plants. It was pretty easy. I just put my finger in there, feel if the soil's wet. And if it is, if it's dry, I water the plant. That was what she told me. What she didn't tell me was volume and how much water to put in there. And I learned the hard way. I should say my plant, my mom's plants learned the hard way that you can't, there's, it's not about, well, it's you put it better here about overwatering. I'll let you word it because I'm sitting here explaining it and you know it better than I do.
So a phrase I often say is overwatering is an issue of frequency. It's not an issue of volume.
God, I wish I'd have been told that.
A lot of people think overwater, you know, they're so afraid to overwater. And so what they'll end up doing instead is love the plants to death by giving them a little itty bitty sip of water, you know, maybe even every day, right? Well, if you only give it a little bit of water every single day or however often that you water the plant, what's happening, there's two bad things that are happening here. Number one, no matter where your water supply is, if it's rainwater, if you live out in the country and you've got well water, if you live in the city and you've got city water, there's going to be some minerals in that water, okay? It's not, none of us are drinking pure H2O, right? Unless we're drinking like reverse osmosis water. So if you only give your plant just a little bit of water, you're going to get a buildup of those minerals at the surface of the plant, okay, right at that top of the layer of the plant. The other thing is, you know, we want roots distributed throughout the entire plant, right? So if we're only giving water at the very, very top and we're not actually watering until water comes out of the bottom of the pot, those roots at the bottom of the pot are never getting access to water. They're starving, right? They're never getting that water. And we're really not encouraging the roots to completely develop throughout the entire pot.
That hit my heart. Oh, man, I feel that. I didn't even realize that.
So whenever you water, and this is going to be true for all of your plants in containers. That's why I always say container plants in containers absolutely must have drainage holes. And this is the reason why. Anytime you water a plant, bucket tomatoes, hanging basket of petunias, your dish garden of succulents, water until water comes out of the bottom of the pot.
That's a great one. That's a really good note. I hope everybody else is marking that down because I know I have a mental note about that now. And just talking about this, Janelle, not trying to get us too into the weeds here or anything, I get that pun. it seems like with a lot of things, we do this with animals a lot too. We tend to think, well, I'm a human being. I need water all the time. My plant probably needs water all the time. We tend to do this like the comparison of, well, what we need and what they need. And I don't know if it's a subconscious thing or not, but it's important to understand that they are not us. There's a difference between us. And while water is vital for both, you know, groups here, it's a little different with us where we need it more consistently than the plants do. And I know that's probably basic for some out there, but apparently some of us need to be learning this one, you know?
You know, I saw something really hilarious. I can't remember if it was Facebook or where, somewhere on social media, but it was somebody talking about how they loved their plant. It was a little succulent, and they loved it so much that they made a little home for it on their, I want to say it was the middle inside of a car, the section between the driver and the passenger. They made a little home for their plant right there, and they thought that it would make the plant happy. And all I could think to myself was, plants don't have feet. They don't want that constant adjustment of light, you know? You park in the shade, you drive home, it's sunny, it's shade. Like, that has got to be just terrible for that plant.
When we talk about this with animals a lot. When you have an animal, it's not about you. It's about the animal. It's about doing right by the animal. If you want to put the, I think it'd be really cute to put this Halloween costume on him. That's for you. The dog or the cat is not interested in wearing that outfit, no matter how much you try to convince yourself of it. It's important to approach these things, plants, animals, any of the above, as it's about them. And what's best for them. And what's best for a plant is not being in a moving vehicle. Like, that does not seem to make a lot of sense. It's the opposite of what a plant would want and everything.
Right.
I think a lot of this can be helped if you walk into any of these situations with that. What's best for the plant? What's best for that? This living thing.
You know, that's where pest management, integrated pest management, it's all about thinking about, you know, first, you know, it's about predicting, you know, then first you got to understand, okay, what does the plant need? And then predict how can things go wrong. You take that approach, you're probably a lot less likely to end up with dead plants.
Wanted to also mention, and we'll talk more about this as we get closer to it, Science by the River coming up September 30th, Saturday. Be sure to be there, everybody. We'll be celebrating this. We'll be talking more and more about it. And we'll meet you down there, Janelle.
Fantastic.
Thanks again for the time. Really appreciate it and love talking with you. Thank you. We'll have more Midday Magazine for you tomorrow right here on WFHR, locally grown radio.
WFHR, Wisconsin Rapids, 1320 AM and W248DE, broadcasting at 97.5 FM.
Stop surfing the dial. You've found the greatest station ever. Locally grown radio 97.5 FM and WFHR 1320 AM.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Monica Ricks in New York. Schools across the Northeast are skipping classes or dismissing students early again because of the heat. In Boston, the mayor declared a heat emergency. WBZ's Beth Hermanos sweating it out in nearby Framingham.
What's the temperature like inside?
Man, it's hot. I can't lie, it's hot.
You glad to get out a little early today?
I'm very happy we got the early release today. It was very, very helpful.
Is it tough to learn when it's this hot?
It is, kind of. It is.
In New York, a former tennis star is begging the U.S. Open to do something, calling conditions there inhumane.
The plea comes after McEnroe watched Daniil Medvedev and Andrei Rublev labor through 93-degree heat during their match on Wednesday. Medvedev said the conditions were brutal.
I couldn't wait to go to the cold shower.
The retractable roof at Arthur Ashe Stadium is closed for rain, but never extreme heat. Erica Herskowitz for CBS News, New York.
Hawaii Senator Mazie Hirono talked about ongoing efforts there a month after deadly wildfires.
The $4 billion in additional FEMA funding the president requested late last week is an important down payment on that promise.
Many residents there are in temporary housing. Rebuilding could take years. Convicted killer Danilo Cavalcante continues to dodge authorities in Pennsylvania after escaping prison. But State Police Lieutenant Colonel George